So welcome to LCG Cybersecurity Talks, a security podcast where we interview experts discussing various cybersecurity topics. Today, I'm talking with Dwayne McDaniel, a GitGuardian developer advocate. Dwayne has been working as a developer relations professional since 2016. He's highly active in a broader tech community, and I met Dwayne through the Security Repo podcast, where he serves as a co-host. Dwayne, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Edvinas. It's a pleasure to be here and talk to you today.
I always start the podcast with very, very simple things. I always like to ask people, how do we start in security? So how did you start in software security? Can you tell your story?
I take a very non-traditional path. It's a conversation I have a lot. I went to school for computer science and then didn't do anything with it. I went and got a job briefly at a bank for mortgage quality assurance. And then I moved to California, got a job in tech sales. So I was in sales pretty much for 12 to 15 years, depending on how you count what constitutes tech sales. For a while, I sold refrigerator gaskets, which was very interesting. But I had a company car in the Bay Area. That was really awesome. Nothing to do with security, though. Then I started at a company called Pantheon, and that's where I flipped over from sales to developer advocacy, developer relations. And I had a boss that was smart enough to say, you're not the enterprise sales rep I need, but there's this other role that has no definition around it that I think you would be good for. And I figured it out, and that's what became the developer relations department. I was the first one, at least at that company. Fast forward on past the pandemic, I needed another job, and I worked for a tooling company called GitKraken, which was awesome. Really cool company, really good tools. I got nothing but good things to say about them, but really wasn't a super great fit for where I wanted to be. What I wanted to do was DevRel and what they actually needed on the ground. And about that same time that I was having those conversations internally, I was also giving a talk called Stop Committing Your Secrets, Git Hooks to the Rescue. I was giving talks about Git because it was a Git tool company, and the security aspect was really fascinating because Git itself isn't any more secure or insecure than anything else. It's just a tool. It's a very powerful tool, but there are ways you can use it and fundamentally be unsafe. And I started having those conversations, and that's when I started citing GitGuardian's State of Secret Sprawl report, and they reached out to me and said, hey, we really like this talk, but you could mention us a little bit more prominently in the end as well as the beginning. Would you like to have a further conversation? And that turned into a serious conversation, which turned into me working for GitGuardian, which is where I'm at now. And that's really my first foray into the world of security. So I took a circuitous route. I didn't wake up one day and say, I want to work in security. I just started talking about security, and it turned out to be something I was passionate about and something I wanted to spend a good chunk of my life doing. So long story short, I fell into it.
This is very fascinating. Thanks for such an interesting story. I think I can just add a few bits as well regarding cybersecurity. My path was not planned either. I was like also drifting and looking for things, and it's never planned. I think it just happens, and you have a lot of life interesting experiences. And it's just like, I also started as a software developer, and yeah, I was not planning to become a cybersecurity specialist. But yeah, anyway, thanks for the story. It was really interesting. And regarding that, you mentioned GitGuardian. I think we shift gears now, and we should talk about, I think, the secrets management. Sure. I have a question. What are exactly the secrets in the context of software development? I mean, I know my audience knows about these things, but I always like to, you know, to start small. So can we talk about it, like, you know, why it's important to manage them?
Yeah, absolutely. I was just having this conversation. I was speaking in Atlanta at Atlanta Cloud Conference, and I was given a talk about honey tokens, and I just kind of barreled in and like started talking about secret sprawl and like how secrets are a major part of what we do. And somebody raised their hand and is like, what do you mean by secrets? And I realized that I hadn't bothered to define the term. I'm so deep into it, I guess I'm so close to the problem set that to me, credential, secret, passwords, API keys, these are all the same word to me. In my head, if I say credential, I mean secret. If I say secret, I mean credential. So that's what we're talking about. When we say secrets, we're talking about the keys, passwords, anything that unencrypts or encrypts data or gives you access to another system. That's the shortest, sweetest definition. So think of your API keys for, you know, AWS or Google Cloud or Stripe or the Slack webhook URLs that let you manipulate Slack from another system. Down to your passwords, where you're actually logging into your systems as a human being. There are essentially two kinds of credential we worry about in the modern world, in the modern world of DevOps and production code. The first is that human entity access. Someone actually has to physically log in. We've addressed that over the years in some interesting ways. SSH keys, I think, is one of the better ones, at least in a pre-quantum cryptography world. You can still use SSH in a post-quantum cryptography fashion, but that is the author authentication piece. Like, I'm a human and I can prove I'm a human. It doesn't deal with the authorization piece, which is another convoluted topic or conflated topic.
Yeah,
where just because I can get in, do I have the rights to do a thing? And that's where I think IAM rules, identity,
yes,
I forget what the AM stands for. Identity and access management. That's what it stands for. That's where that really comes in. It's like, I can prove I'm me through this system, and that same system also grants me certain rights in certain circumstances. I can do certain things under certain circumstances.
Yeah.
And I like that. So from the human side, I think we're approaching it pretty well, and we're figuring it out. The problem still is long-lived credentials. If you can get rid of credentials, get rid of them. If you can get into a system through some other, like, hardware, so you always have to authenticate in it somehow, but like through hardware token, I'm a firm believer in that. YubiKey is an amazing technology, Google Titan keys, biometrics that are hardware-based, not software-based. Software-based yeah. biometrics scare me, but if it's related to my hardware on my physical machine, yeah. I trust that. I have a Mac in front of me that I'm talking into, and that's how I turn it on. Like, that's how I get into my bank. It's all hardware-based. Based on my phone and the hardware inside that. And then there's the other kind of credential, which is, I think, the bigger problem, not as far as like credentials aren't a problem with it, but it's the non-human entities is how I always phrase it. I think what we've arrived at in DevOps is calling it workload identity management. I've heard that term a lot in the last at least couple of months. So we're managing these workloads, these servers, these machines that connect to each other, these machine entities, these Kubernetes clusters, and services that need to talk to each other. Like the database inside of a pod needs to talk to an application server on another pod. The number I just recently heard at a talk was 48 to 1. So for every human entity, you have 48 machine entities you need to deal with.
Wow, that's a big number.
It is. And that's the problem set is we keep coming back to, like, how do we authenticate that? And we keep approaching it the same way we did with humans, but like, well, we're just going to give it an ID. We're going to give it a pass key and we have a username pass for the system. And that worked. Except long-lived keys for machines don't have the same physical touch of a human being always interacting with them. You would never put your personal password in a bit of code. Like, I hope you would never do that, but
no.
Developers put machine identity tokens and API keys into code all the time. Sometimes it's done just, I want to do it temporarily. We all been there. We just got to make sure that database actually works. We got to make sure that endpoint is the right endpoint. And let's just hard code it real quick. We're going to take it right back out. And if you do that, that's fine. I'm not going to tell anybody that's a bad practice. The problem is the bad practice when you don't take it immediately back out. Then you go flip to another screen, you open another file, you work on another ticket, and an hour later, you have no idea what you did or didn't do. And now it's time to go to bed and it's 3 a.m. So you do what we all do in an emergency, which is save, git add all, git commit, pick it up tomorrow and go to bed. And you push. That's the real problem is you push that thing into the public or into a private repo. But private repos, as we know, don't stay private forever.
Yeah, they become public.
a week for a number of reasons. We can go down a whole rabbit hole with that problem set, but that's what we're talking about. Identifying machine resource identity management for machine resources and for humans, coming down to a long-lived string that is stored somewhere. Yep. That long-lived string is the secret, the credential that we need to worry about, because in the past year, we've seen the number one reason or the number one way that attackers established that first breach has become stolen passwords or leaked, gaining ill-gotten passwords. Vulnerabilities are, according to Sophos, it was down to 17%. I think IBM said it was 19% are vulnerabilities. So patching is still important. But I think it points to that we've kind of figured that out. Like, patching is super important. Not that everybody does it all the time, not everybody does it right. But we hear that message so much that patch, get the latest updates, the most latest stable updates, get rid of those vulnerabilities. And that is driving that vulnerability approach down. Yeah. But at the same time, we're leaving passwords in our code more often. And we know this because GitGuardian puts out the state of secret sprawl report, where last year we found almost 12.8 million different passwords out in public. 3.8 million of those were valid. 71%, or no, I'm sorry, I think it's 90%. I didn't have to go read the part. 90% were still valid after 5 days. So we check them, we find them, then we keep trying to validate them over the course of 5 days. And that was just a shocking number. Like, this is the first year we included that in the report. Attackers find these things, and the easiest way in is just walk through the front door. That's just getting your AWS account because I got the keys, and oh, this happened to be the root account. I now own everything you will ever own, and I can keep persistently being in there because I can now, as an admin, keep creating new identities with passwords, with weak passwords that I can keep getting in with. That's literally the Microsoft problem right now. They don't know how to get certain state actors out of certain systems.
Yeah, Microsoft. I think I can also add from experience, like you mentioned that, you know, secrets are in the code. Like, and I as a developer, I've been working for a small company in Denmark for 2 years. And I can say I made all the mistakes before learning cybersecurity, right? And all these kind of concepts. Yeah, I committed secrets by mistake. That happened. We also did the tech, as you said, test keys and stuff like that in the code. And yeah, we forgot about it. So yeah, everybody makes mistakes, but it's important to not to have those secrets in the code.
I recently saw a talk where someone was explaining how they, as a bug bounty person, as a white hat hacker, his goal is to get into AWS accounts. Like, that is his explicit, he likes doing that. And whatever path he has to go through to get there. And he started the whole talk with saying, sometimes all you got to do is look at what's in public. And he showed a screenshot of source code from a front end website, from a actual production website from a company. And there's a comment in it that says, please remove the following AWS credentials before this hits production. And below it was the actual AWS keys. Like, yep, those were valid. And guess this was in production. It's not just like deep in the code. It's not just like this deep DevOps problem. It is anything that is code, period, has the liability or the likelihood that it's going to leak at some point into someone's eyes are going to see it that probably shouldn't have.
Yeah. Yeah. We talked a lot about secrets, keys, and all that jazz. I would like to talk about GitGuardian, about your role in GitGuardian. I think I can quickly start to say that. I tested that product in Bestseller when I worked as a developer. It was a really great product, and we really liked it. The secret exposure and showcasing that in dashboard was amazing. That really helped the company to improve from security perspective. But I would like to also hear from your side. I mean, you work as a GitGuardian advocate, and what in general, maybe we can talk more about GitGuardian now.
Oh, sure. So, developer relations, I explained my title and like how I fell into it and got security, but I didn't explain what I do. And that's always a tricky thing that we could be here for the next hour, just trying to explain what developer relations is overall. I fall into the side of developer relations closer to developer evangelism, and tech evangelism, which is really where I want to be, which is like where I really love doing it. I see the job as five simple words: help people figure stuff out. That's it. If I'm doing that, I'm doing my job. And I've always been guided by that. Now that what that looks like day to day changes day to day, depending on the day. Like for instance, the deliverable I'm working on right this minute is writing a new talk for B-Sides SF, San Francisco. And that's helping people hopefully figure out auto rotation of secrets. There are multiple ways to approach that. It doesn't need to be that complicated. But that's me helping people figure stuff out. It's also blog posts that explain what our products do, what the problem sets are, reach exposures, like, hey, this happened out in the real world. You could stay safe by learning from this. I'm a big believer in that. I'm a big believer you can learn a lot from research and from other people's mistakes. This is like how airplane travel. I know there's a few things with Boeing going on right now, but there's airplane travel is still the safest way to travel. And it got that way from every accident being a giant learning experience and the entire industry going like, we can't let that ever happen again. Like, we got to figure this out. Like, we need to fix this at a global scale. Security traditionally, up until the DevOps movement really, was like, there's a security incident. Yep, we're making best efforts and that's all you'll hear. In fact, a lot of companies still approach it like that.
Yeah.
But we really in the last, I think, since I've been paying attention to it, accelerated the disclosure, like with SEC disclosures like 10Ks and 8Ks. Now we have to be a little more transparent about all of these breaches. But trying to help people like gather those learnings together and like, what do I do about that? The thing I find myself saying the most and has nothing to do with GitGuardian is enable multi-factor authentication. It solves so many problems with human identity and human authentication and people trying to take over accounts. But anyway, the other thing I do is make videos. If you go to our YouTube channel, you'll see me make these minute-ish long videos that explain a specific feature. I really like making those, and we keep making new ones. In fact, I got a new one I got to make this week. On our new launch. In fact, today, the day we're recording this, is the same day we launched our SCA product, which is static code analysis, source code analysis. It's the supply chain tool where we're looking at your dependencies and seeing what vulnerabilities are there, help you create SBOMs, help you understand the licensing implications. That's one of the more overlooked parts of SCA. Is
just have one question. I'm sorry for cutting you off.
Of course.
Like, it really sounded really good with the new product. I was just curious, like, does it analyze the functions, like the level of code as well? Like, you know, like, is the code kind of like
wrote? No, we're not doing individual like inspection of, hey, you did an anti-pattern here. That's not what it's for. It is vulnerabilities and components, dependencies in those components, like understanding the transverse dependencies all the way down. We worked really hard on getting that right and tuning that. And of course, you get the dashboard, API-driven dashboard interface with it. That's the thing. Like, I really, really like the SCA tools out there for like kicks and check marks. Great tools. I'm going to say awesome things about open source here, but they are CLI tools. Like, there's no clean dashboard that I can manage the remediation process with. You get, in fact, the guy who I saw give a whole talk about how awesome Kix was pulled up a spreadsheet he made of like all the things that needed to fix. I'm like, that's where like the rubber meets the road. Is like, all right, well, you can find these things, but what do you do about them? And that's where, again, our platform is geared to do, because we tuned that with a secrets remediation at scale. And I mentioned API driven because some people hate dashboards. I'm like, can I just tie this into my Seam or SOAR or other orchestration tooling that I've built? And the answer is absolutely yes. We want you to.
That's a great approach.
Figure that out. So that's the other piece that I work on slightly, is figuring out how to better describe our APIs and whatnot. There's a repo out there, the GitGuardian GitHub instance, or I guess the GitHub account. You'll find all sorts of helpful bits of code out there. We have an example repo that if you want to get started with our API and have never really worked with an API, I have a whole guide, a whole Jupyter notebook based approach to just running the commands one at a time and then building bigger scripts and slowly automating your entire response. Like, automation is the only way we can scale.
That's great. That's great. Yeah, I agree with you about automation, and especially API integrations. But you mentioned the dashboards. A lot of security people hate dashboards. That's the most important thing, to have one place where you can focus. And, you know, if it's too many, then it becomes, yeah, very bad thing.
Since the beginning of interacting with machines, everyone's always wanted a single pane of glass.
Exactly. They always sell that.
it's not new. This has been going on for decades. Everybody just wants one. It used to be one piece of paper, because that's what you interacted with computers. They printed out one piece of paper. But now you want one piece of glass. You don't want a 30-page PDF. You want two pages that explain everything in the system.
Yeah. I think we need to address one interesting thing in this conversation. We haven't touched that. I want to talk about secure development culture. And this is my own personal question. I'm working with a team of developers where we are mitigating vulnerabilities in web apps, right? But the issue is that developers and IT security people are not very friendly towards each other. So I'm basically asking how the organization can foster that culture where we don't see each other as like enemies, but we are working in harmony and, you know, fixing things. And can you give some like advice, input regarding this?
I just want to put a quick caveat here that I am not a security manager. I am not a team lead on DevOps. So this is coming from the perspective of someone who's just worked in a bunch of companies.
Yeah.
I mostly worked in startups, smaller team culture. I think the largest company I worked for in the last two decades was like 300 people. So I'm approaching this from a get rid of silos first mentality across the board. As soon as you build that wall of you're on that team and I'm on this team, I think this applies to broader life too. Like, you're this, I'm a that. We're kind of started missing the point. Like, the question shouldn't be whose responsibility was this? Who can I point the finger at? It's like, what were we actually trying to do? And how do we get there together? Obviously, nobody wants their code hacked and the company to be breached and then lose money and layoffs and fire people. Like, nobody wants that.
Nobody.
What we want is it always reminds me of that old cartoon of two people on either side of the number six, and one person's looking at it and it looks like a nine to them, and the other person looks at it and it looks like a six to them. Or maybe it's a nine in the picture. It's sideways, so you don't really know. It's all about perspective. But it's understanding that, hey, we should be one team. I personally deeply feel that we kind of went off track when we made the security team a separate team. Security should just be everyone's job, and it's like part of your baked-in responsibilities. Now, don't mishear me. Incident responders and SOC employees and SOC analysts, absolutely, you're doing miracle works out there. So thank you very much for all the service. But if your job is you feel like I'm just saying no to everyone all the time, that puts you in that adversarial position. Nobody wants to hear no.
No,
everyone likes hearing your idea is a good idea. Let's build on that. So I think if we get to a point, and this is a very large cultural shift, a point of embedding more security people that are making these decisions directly with developers, directly with those teams, and being in earlier in the process. We keep hearing about shift left. And I think most of the industry has interpreted that, at least marketing for most of the industry, interpreted that as let's give developers more tools to jam up their workflows. Let's stop them from making commits. And I say that as a company who also builds a tool that lets you build Git hooks that will stop you from getting a commit into your, or stop you from putting a secret into the actual commit. If it never makes the commit, it never makes the pipeline, and then you're safe. And I firmly believe that's a good approach. But overall, we need to step back and say, well, where's left? What does left even mean? And if you step all the way back, left means the discovery phase at the beginning of the project. Is there a security person in the room when that first whiteboard diagram gets drawn? It's like, this is what we think we want to build, and here's the basic architecture we want to use. Is someone raising their hand and saying, can we actually use that data? Do we have a security protocol in place for that platform? Have we ever thought through like this scenario if we build something like this? And not to say no, but to ask the question early, because the answer probably is we can figure it out. But if they don't have the conversation early enough, then they build something, it gets sent over for testing. Security team's like, nope, you didn't think about this. Go rework this. And now everybody's mad because you've wasted how much time?
I always remind
people that whiteboard ink is the cheapest investment your company can ever make with the highest return on investment. It's so cheap to erase a line while it's still just a whiteboard ink. I put a circle around something and say, we need to fix this before we can do this. And it will make the world move a lot faster. Now, that is, again, saying that with the caveat that I don't run a team. So I know there's a lot of friction. That's like kind of Pollyanna talking, where it's like pie in the sky. Can't we all just get along? Kumbaya. There's a character, John, in the Phoenix Project, who is that always saying no, always shutting things down. And it comes to a head. I'm not going to ruin the book for anybody, but once he figures out my job is to support the goals of the company, not just to say no, not just to be, this was unsafe, do it again. Then things start flowing a lot faster, a lot better. And people start having fun, in the book anyway, fun with security, that it's like constant pen testing. It's constant, like early in the process, like you've just pushed a piece of code. Like now you're getting it attacked to show like, and this is actually what would happen if we went all the way with this. Let's solve it quick. And let's shrink that cycle down to as quick as possible. That's my favorite definition of DevOps anybody ever said ever. With Kelly Albright, who up in the Boston area, agile consultant these days, as far as I know, he said, DevOps is all about shortening the communication feedback loop. That's not about goals. It's not about Scrum. It's not about Agile. It is about getting feedback as fast as possible to make decisions faster so you can get things out the door faster.
Yeah, that's a great quote. And I totally agree with you. I think the most important thing is to work together. And I think the first step is always hard. But once you start it, I think it's quick and easy to do whiteboards. And instead of just, you know, having it in the end of it when then start complaining about it. So companies have to work together. People have to work together. And that's the hardest part. But I believe that things can change. And I think with that, I think we'll be wrapping the podcast. I wanted to thank you very much. It's nice to talk with a professional like you and learning a lot. I think if you have anything to plug, now is the time. I think Git Guardian new report, that could be one, right? You just released a new one, 2024.
Yeah. The State of Secret Sprawl report. It's not behind sign up. Just show up to the, just Google it, State of Secret Sprawl Report 2024. Follow one of those links. Google, we've indexed like three different links. Google indexed three completely different links.
Yeah.
At least last time I checked. Follow one of those. You'll be able to click to download. That's it. Just, you can read the report. Other thing I would love everyone to do is go listen to my podcast, the Security Repo Podcast. Just go look that up, the Security Repo Podcast. It's the only thing called that. It's on Apple and Spotify, and we even have a YouTube if you want to see our videos, but most people listen to it as a podcast. And the easiest way to follow my adventures, like you can feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn and whatnot, and those will be in the show notes, but our blog. I'm very, very proud of the work I get to do with Git Guardian and writing on their blog. I didn't finish my thought earlier on going what I do. A good chunk of what I do, about probably 40% of my job, is to go to events and give talks. So I'm giving sessions at talks all the time. Last year I gave 40 different talks across 45 events that I participated in. 38 of that was in person. This year I'm kind of on track to hit the mid-30s in number of events. Easiest way to like see where I'm going to be is on our events page, because it'll say what events we're coming up on. But I always try to write a recap post when possible, if I can, and it fits into the content schedule of all the events. So I just released the one on Scale, the Southern California Linux Expo. That was turned into a huge piece because there was so much good content. I still had to cut it down by half at the end of the day when through edits. There'll be one coming out on the Atlanta Cloud Conference, which I mentioned earlier in the episode. That'll be out probably by the time this is out. And you can go look at our conferences and see where I've been and what I've learned. I'm standing on the shoulders of giants out there. The only reason I know anything about anything is because I had the fortune to go to sessions and hear an expert or someone who's passionate about it, at least, talk about it and push me down that path of discovery. That's the biggest joy of what I do for a living, is I get to continually learn, and no 2 days look quite the same.
Okay, amazing. Thanks for the resources. Yeah, big thank you to you. And we will be back next month with a new episode. See you, Dwayne.
Thank you.